The Speaking of Cults podcast is presented solely for general informational, educational, and entertainment purposes. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from it is at the user's own risk. The views, information, or opinions expressed by the host and guests are solely those of the individuals involved and do not constitute medical or other professional advice. And hello, everybody. It looks like we are live. And let's see. Let's make sure that we've got sound here. I'm not hearing myself at this end. Are you guys hearing me, or is this not coming? Okay, we are looking good. All right. I'm just having speaker issues, I guess, which is fine with me. As long as you guys can hear me, that's what I'm happy about. All right. Excellent. So yeah, we're going live this week for the Speaking of Cults podcast because I wanted to sort of go over these things that we're going to be talking about today, and I wanted to do it with some feedback from you guys and sort of, you know, not necessarily like Q&A like back and forth, but, you know, but some back and forth, you know, some feedback as we're going here. So I'm throwing the comments up there. And okay, and it's a little low volume. That's interesting. All right, well, let me make sure that I'm also talking right into the mic as well. All right, so what we're going to... I've been waiting for what I think is... I think right now... you know, a lot of the noise in this space and this ex-Scientology world right now is kind of starting to, you know, sort of taper off. And I'm very happy to just stay focused on what the purpose of this channel is, right? Which is to help people and try to offer information and support and you know, and maybe a little bit of guidance or whatever, and just try to do the best that I can do doing this. And so I got to thinking recently about all kinds of things, as I do. And good, I'm glad you guys can hear me just fine. Excellent. Oh, hey, welcome to the channel, Bigfoot. Awesome. Always happy to have new viewers and new listeners. And this will post, this one that we're doing today will post later on as an audio only podcast as well, as usual. So I've got papers here today. And I have been thinking a lot over the last couple months about the toll that it takes to speak out against your abusers. And I titled the show this way because I wanted to include not just the ex-cult world in this, but also, you know, when we talk about coercive control, we're talking about a repeating pattern of abusive behavior that can happen anywhere, almost in any context. It doesn't just have to be with cults or cult leaders or, you know, these sort of predatory, you know, narcissist type figures. Charismatic leaders will gather people around them and will use them to their advantage and take advantage of them, you know, that kind of thing. That happens all the time. And it happens in religious contexts, it happens in non-religious contexts, happens in business settings. We, you know, we can talk about multi-level marketing schemes, as well as also, though, talking about domestic situations and partnerships that go bad or relationships that go wrong and abusers that abuse in those places, in those spaces. Are abusers too. And when we survive, you know, escape and survive a situation like that, or, you know, and hopefully not a number of them, hopefully just one's enough, right? Because they're a repeating pattern of behavior, it happens over time. And we're, you know, and we're usually, it's something that we're involved in and emotionally committed to. It's something we really want to be part of or really have invested ourselves in. And that's really where so much of the pain and trauma comes from, is from that investment that we make. You know, it's if some Joe, you know, or whatever came up and, you know, just kind of slapped you out of nowhere, you know, it wouldn't have anywhere near the emotional impact and trauma and lasting effect that it would have if you're, if the love of your life, you know, if your guru, if people who really mattered to you came and slapped you around, that would have a lot more impact and it would have a lot more lasting effect. And that's the trauma that we talk about that comes from being part of these groups or part of that situation of coercive control. And the abuse that comes with it, whether it's physical abuse or whether it's emotional, psychological kind of abuse, it's still abuse. And when you are, when someone is, oh gosh, yes, exactly, toxic workplaces, right? Absolutely. When you find yourself or when people find themselves in that situation, and then they come out of it, they escape from it, they then have to deal with it. And so that's all what we've been talking about forever on this channel, right? Because that's been my journey and the journey of so many other people. And, you know, many of you have experienced similar situations in your own life. But then there's the additional aspect of, well, what if you want to do something about it? What if you want to step up, step out, decide, you know, I'm not just escaping, but I want to do something. And depending on who you are, what skills you have, your temperament, your initiative, your trauma, all of these things, your character, your integrity, your emotional needs, your education, all of these things, I'm sitting here just rattling off, right, have everything to do with how you're going to deal with that experience. And a lot of us don't have a lot of experience at, or haven't had, you know, when you first get out of a cult, unless you were involved in some kind of PR work or, you know, public in front of a camera work or some other kind of public policy work or some kind of legal work. You know, very few of us are in a position when we come out of a cult, you know, just to get down to the brass tacks of it here, really being in any position to do much of anything. We have very little power, very little influence, you know, especially when your life has been devastated by a coercive situation. And even if you do have power, you do feel like, you know, you are somebody and you have a voice and you should use it. Even if you do feel that way, there's an awful lot of, well, what do I do? Where do I go? Who should I be talking to? How should I be talking about this? What is possible and what's not possible? Because, you know, tempering all of this with reality is, you know, it can be challenging. We can have, anyway, there are a lot of challenges. There's a lot of challenges. And so I thought, why not dedicate an episode to what that's all about? What the, you know, the challenges, the pitfalls and the difficulties of trying to speak out and speak up and do something about what happened to you. And yeah, it can even happen with family members. That's right. And every context is different, right? They're all, we talk about the same kinds of behaviors, same kind of abuses, but how they come out, right? How it happens to us can be so wildly different that, you know, you then try to look at, well, what can I do about this? And, you know, if it's a family, well, there's a certain set of things you can do. If it's the Church of Scientology, there's other things you can do. And if it's a government agency, oh God, you know, well, now what am I gonna do? Testify in front of Congress? Like, what do I need to do here, right? You get, you know, trying to figure this out can be a real challenge all by itself. But unfortunately, it's not just as simple as, well, let me just figure out the means and ends of this problem and I will just solve it. And in my, you know, greatness magnificence, I'm going to step up and I'm going to just wipe this cult off the face of the earth. I'm just going to get this abuser put in jail. Just watch me, right? We're all ready to go. And and if only it was that easy, right? If only it was that easy. Because we come out of often come out of coercive situations, certainly cult situations, MLM situations, abusive, culty type situations. All kinds of screwed up up here, right? All kinds of messed up, all kinds of uncertainties, all kinds of, you know, the effects of gaslighting, the effects of complex PTSD, the effects of all the trauma, of all of the pressures that were constantly put on the person in the cult, where their whole fight flight, you know, mechanism is just exhausted. Exhausted, right? It's just in constant overdrive. And there's, you know, and the hypervigilance that can come with that, and the anxiety that can come with that. And let's, you know, and these are all things that, you know, anyway, yeah. Yeah. So it can be hard. There's a lot of challenges. So let's talk about what some of those challenges are. Let's go ahead and just get to it. First off, point number one, and I have 8 points to go over with you guys today. A lot of points. Emotional trauma. Many individuals, I've just got little summary bits here I'll just kind of go over, and then we can kind of talk about it, right? Many individuals who leave destructive cults experience emotional trauma due to manipulation, exploitation, and abuse within the cult. Revisiting these experiences while fighting back against the cult can re-traumatize individuals, leading to symptoms such as anxiety, depression, PTSD, and feelings of guilt or shame. Now, recently it was pointed out, I talked last night about RICE, this four-step or this four points or pillars of human behavior or motivation, what it is that drives people to do things. And in the talk that that I heard this last week from this guy, Andrew Bustamante, who's this former CIA guy, he talked about the value of anxiety and how the CIA, as an organization that recruits people who are going to be spies or do undercover work, treat people with anxiety as though they have a bit of a superpower, because it gives you things that people who don't have anxiety don't have, like, you know, more increased perception and situational awareness, heightened sense of perception of what's going on around you all the time. You know, that anxiety can be something that can be positive for you. That was a really interesting point, and one that I took to heart and thought quite a bit about, because obviously what that brings to mind for me is that anxiety, stress, trauma, you know, difficult memories or experiences and the after effects and consequences of those, these are all evolutionarily designed things. They're traits that we have and biological functions that are carried out for a reason. And I don't think that they're just bugs in our system. And that's a really important point to make, I think, when it comes to trauma and anxiety and these things, right? It's a little hard, off the top of my head, to see the evolutionary advantages of depression. And yet, depression is actually a combination of a lot of complicated behaviors and things up here. It's not just this one thing. There's all kinds of things connected to the concepts of or the experience of depression. So it's just kind of interesting to think about these things in a more well-rounded, well, there's pros and cons kind of way. That being said, the emotional trauma of an ex-cult member can be fierce and intense and very, very deep. Years and years of experiences that create a complex PTSD situation are going to take their toll on somebody. And this is not where it's a net positive for a person in their life. So I think that there's a point or a level that, you know, may be individual for each of us as to where that line is, where we cross over from, okay, this is anxiety that I can use or utilize, or is maybe can be trained into me as a benefit rather than a bug. But some of this is just way too, you know, there's a line that gets crossed and there's just too much. We're overwhelmed by the trauma, by the experiences, by the fact that we can't reconcile whatever it was about the experience that lingers with us or sticks in our brains, right? Or in our whole body, really. And so it's bad enough trying to deal with all that baggage that you carry around with you coming out of the cult. Maybe you go get therapy if you can afford it, if you can find it, if you can get a good therapist. Maybe you go read some books. Maybe you go watch some videos. Maybe you get some education. I really hope you do, because that's, for me, absolutely key for people to be able to recover, be able to move on, be able to reconcile and come to a place of acceptance and peace with what happened to you. You know, lots of ways of describing this or putting this, but this is all sort of what I think about it. But when you go take on your abuser, when you go back into the mix and have to deal with the accusations and the work that is necessary to fight that abuser, to expose that abuser, to document the series of events that occurred that would constitute abusive behavior. You know, if you're going to expose this stuff or prosecute this stuff, you have to prove it. And in order to prove it, you have to have evidence. In order to have that evidence, you got to go collect it. And very few people, in fact, I've never met one person who came out of their experience fully armed and ready to rock when it came to taking on their abusers. Most of the time, they were getting away in the middle of the night. You know, it was, get me out of here. It's, you know, it's that kind of a situation. Or it was a slow and steady, and then they just kind of got themselves away and out of it, and it never occurred to them while they were in, hey, you know what? I better bring a thumb drive packed full of documents, right? It sometimes that occurs to people, you know, when they have sort of a whistleblower kind of mentality, but often it doesn't. And like I said, I've never met one person who did that. So documentation and going back and finding and digging all that up, or going back and doing all the research that you need to do to uncover all the truth of it, I consider these things pretty important and good things to do. I don't know that it's absolutely necessary that every single person who leaves a cult situation needs to go back and document and learn the entire history of what they were part of. Sometimes it's perfectly fine to just leave it behind. But if you want to do this, you know, this kind of expose kind of work, or fight back against it, you're going to have to go do that stuff. And the point obviously being that you're going to be re-traumatizing yourself in the process of doing this. And I don't want to just blow that off or push that under the carpet as an unimportant fact, because that's the whole point of the show today, right? And this first point is a powerful one. It's hard to do this work as an ex-cult member or as a trauma survivor against your abusers, because it does re-traumatize you. And re-traumatization ain't fun. And I'm going to try to offer some examples from my own personal life here today on some of this stuff. And what I can say about this is that it is... it's triggering and difficult because it sets up or stimulates, or whatever word you want to use, these negative feedback loops in your brain, right? These like negative message loops, this constant like voices in your head, or these ideas that just won't leave. You know, I think we all know what I'm talking about. That, you know, putting yourself back in the deep end over and over again, right? You start feeling like, you're losing the energy, you can't tread the water, right? It's like, God damn, because it follows you around. You know, it's not like, okay, I'm going to sit down at my computer today and I'm going to spend 3 hours researching L. Ron Hubbard and here we go and No, you're horrified by what you learn. You're shocked and appalled, and it's very triggering, right? You're like, my God. This guy put somebody in a 4-year-old in a chain locker, and then he did this, and then he did this, and then he beat his wives, and he tried to abort his kids, and he beat on his kids, and he this and he that. And you're like, my God, I knew it was bad, but Jesus Christ, this is really horrible, because all the stuff that you weren't looking at when you were in is suddenly on your face, right? It's on your head. And you got to, you know, you got to process and deal with all that new information and new levels of nonsense while it's going. And obviously with that comes the hindsight bias that we've talked about, that blame, shame, regret that you, that you know, that you can start feeding yourself. I couldn't believe it. How could I be this stupid? I'm such an ignorant moron. I'm so dumb. I'm look at me. I'm an idiot. I'm a fool. Like, you just pull out the thesaurus and you just start coming up with every name, right? Every fucking insult you can give yourself, you do. And it goes into this negative feedback loop. Like I said, multiples of them, you know, you can have a lot of these things even going at once, all these voices in your head and all this negative emotion and all this like really guilty, self-defeating kind of stuff can really hit you quite hard. And it's a, and it can come and go in waves. You know, it's here one day, it's here one hour, and then it's kind of gone for a while. And then it kind of comes back, or you do something, and then it, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, ugh. So re-traumatization of victims by, you know, the re-exposure of them to the source of the trauma is very definitely, you know, one of the tolls that is taken by this whole thing, okay? So that's our first point. Yeah, you guys are talking here in the comments about this stuff, and, yeah, and there you go, right? But also, oh, there we go. That's a great one, Stanley. Personally, I've learned to thank my abuser for showing me I'm unstoppable. That's awesome. All right. Another thing that can come up, another challenge, let's say, in the course of all of this is loss of identity. I hope you guys like the titling I'm putting up on the screen today. I set this whole thing up today for the podcast. Loss of identity, all right? Cults often control members' thoughts, behaviors, and beliefs, leading to a loss of personal identity, right? You become subsumed into the cult. Your personality is taken over by the group and the cult leader to the point that you are acting like and duplicating and wanting to be or emulate the cult leader and the cult culture. And even in a domestic partnership or a gang situation or something, there are all kinds of shades of this. Identity, personality theory, there's a lot on this, but definitely it is the case that you change as a person drastically when you're in one of these situations. And leaving that cult and challenging its beliefs can leave individuals grappling with questions of identity and purpose as they navigate life outside the cult's influence. So identity and purpose are almost entirely foreign concepts, you know, to a lot of people who leave destructive cult situations. They're lost. They feel adrift. They literally feel like they're, you know, holding on to a, you know, the door at the end of Titanic, right? They're just floating out in the water, and they have no idea how to even get over the next wave. Where do I go? What direction do I move in? Who am I? What is all of this meant? Right? And a lot of bad habits and action patterns, you know, and this kind of stuff follow the person outside the cult. Because they don't know really how else to think yet. All the reacclimation needs to happen. And the struggle with identity and purpose is very, very real. Finding a purpose in fighting back against the abusers is certainly a way to go. And certainly I can, you know, definitely say can give you an incredible feeling of goal-oriented motivation and purpose, right? But even that can become a little all-consuming, can't it? We can get too much into fighting the cult and forget that we have a whole life to live and build and grow and nurture, right, and experience. And yeah, I kind of did that for a little while, sure, you know, in terms of needing to do something significant and important Because from the cult I came from, that was the whole tagline of being part of it, is that we were doing something important. We were doing something substantial. And nothing else really held a candle to what we were doing. So that's a, you know, I'm amazed I could get through doorways, right? Because my head was so goddamn big as a Scientologist. And for many years after Scientology, you know, trying to deflate that thing and like kind of get back into some perspective of my real place in the world and what I can and can't do. That's all part of getting that identity back, right? It's not just ego deflation. It's like kind of figuring out who you are and what, and who you want to be, you know, that kind of stuff. And if you are, and I can tell you again from personal experience with this, that if you spend too much time invested in fighting the cult, this is your new mission. Fair enough. You know, I want people doing this. I'm not discouraging people from fighting their abusers or fighting back. What I'm trying to say is temper it with perspective and don't let anything, any one thing, take over your life in the same way the cult did. And it's really hard for ex-cult members to do that sometimes because we're so used to, so habituated to being full on dedicated to a thing. And if you're not fully dedicated to it, you're not even doing it. You don't even, none of your, you know, it doesn't even matter. Why bother? It's all or nothing. Well, that's that black and white thinking that comes from the cult, isn't it? You know, and nuance is the key word for regaining yourself and regaining your life, is coming back into a nuanced point of view about reality and about your thinking and about life. And that's a great question, Auntie. Is it getting one's identity back or build another? I guess it requires how young one was sucked into a cult. That is a great question because there are competing theories and ideas about this when it comes to the psychology of it. My take is, and I think I've talked about this before, is that yes, a pre-cult personality can be a thing. In other words, who you were before you entered into the cult and fully invested yourself into it and became this cult member rather than the individual that you were. That happened to me when I was 15, right? At 15 years old. Up until that time, I knew about Scientology. It was a very important part of my life, but I didn't really think of myself as a Scientologist. And that's an interesting thing for me to say, but it's true. I was around it. I knew it. I knew the terminology of it, but I didn't really commit to it until I was 15. So up until then, I had this sort of pre-cult personality. And once I hit it and started adopting Scientology as my thing and making me, you know, turning myself into a Scientologist, my personality was then twisted and sort of aligned with L. Ron Hubbard and the concept of the ideal Scientologist. And eventually the ideal, you know, staff member, and then the ideal Sea Org member, right? What are these things entail? And that's who I was trying to be and striving so hard to focus all of my efforts and attention on. So when I came out of Scientology, I didn't necessarily try to go back and be 15 years old again. But it was kind of interesting how, in terms of stages of development, that is kind of right where I went back to for a long time, right? And sort of kind of re-go through some of those stages and finish them and develop, right? Do some more development, even at 42 years old. So we could call that whole process, right? You look at it through a lens of identity and go, yeah, okay. So I was kind of, you know, readopting and picking back up and myself, my own identity, my pre-cult identity, and rejecting a lot of the cult stuff. But realistically speaking, now that that's kind of, if that all makes sense, for me, it wasn't that black and white of an experience. And I don't think about it that in that black and white of a way, as, you know, oh, I just went back to my pre-cult personality. I think about it more of our personalities are a continuing evolution of change all through our life. And when we're in a cult experience, there's this whole other dominating force that sort of crushes your own personal initiative and feelings and ego under the wheel of the cult or the abuser, right? Because this, again, applies in domestic situations. And you have to conform. There's a conformity culture, if you will, to a coercive situation. That's the whole point, is the coercive abuser is forcing you to comply and conform. And so you're limited in your actions. You have your choices are suddenly bound, as Dr. Yanya Lauch talks about. So I think that your ability to develop your personality or be who you want to be or who you think you are is kind of crushed under that. And once that weight is lifted and you're escaped from that, you're no longer part of that, you're kind of free suddenly. Ah! You can go anywhere, any direction you want. Go this way, do this, do that, go back to school, go get a job, go live with your parents, go get on the road, go buy a mobile home and travel. Like all these possible paths for your future are now available to you again. And you got to figure out what you want to do with that. And I think that, you know, building your new life, I guess you could say, outside of that oppression starts developing your personality in a whole new direction. So you're not just going backwards. I think it's a constant forward move. But if you've had all these holes in your past of stages of development, or, you know, things you didn't learn or things that passed you by that you didn't know anything about, cultural stuff, educational stuff, you know, you can go back and fill in those blanks and think about it that way. But I like to think of it as a constant moving forward. That's my take on it. Auntie, that's a great, great analogy. Thank you. That's why I wanted to do this live today, because I knew I would get wonderful feedback like this. It sounds to me like going to prison, where you have to act a very different way for such a long time that it changes you, but when you get out, you're still you, but affected by it. Exactly. Exactly. And if you have ever spent any time with real people who've come out of jail or prison for extended periods of time, you see behavior and uncertainty and problems with all of these things very similar to what you see with ex-cult members. I'm not saying it's exactly the same, because it's not. There's all kinds of differences. Being in prison is a very different experience from being in a cult, because the reasons you were there, for example, are wildly different. So, you know, how you got there, what you get to do, and your perception of yourself during the experience, wildly different. But it's still a great analogy for the personality part, so I want to say that. Okay, so let's carry on. So this identity thing's kind of a big deal. And taking on, and again, where it comes in here in terms of the cult stuff is fighting the cult. The toll that this can take on people, you know, in the ex-cult space is you're still defining, you know, I don't want it to be this way. I'm not saying this in a degrading or insulting way, because I've lived this life for 10 years now. And I got to be honest, right? To the degree that you continue to define yourself and your identity by the cult, now you're not a cult member, you're a cult fighter. Well, that's great. That's good. That's not, like I said, we need it. We want it. We need this activity. But if you let that become the whole of your new identity, you're still letting the cult kind of run your life, aren't you? You know, somebody pointed that out to me years ago, and I've had varying degrees of acceptance and rejection of that idea over the years, right? It's taken me years to kind of embrace the fact that that's true. right? To the degree you're letting, you know, that the cult is still in your life and is a significant force in your life, driving your, you know, giving you meaning and purpose, you know, it can still stay in your life. You can't really move on. And that can be difficult sometimes, right? It can keep some of the PTSD triggers in place and some of the other stuff in place. And it can be harder to deal with that stuff because it's constantly being reminded to you, you know? It's a struggle, right? In other words, I think it's important for everybody out there to know that us ex-cult fighters are not necessarily representative of every ex-cult member out there. You know, there's a whole, and of course, a lot of you know this, right? You're ex-cult members yourselves, or you're survivors of coercive situations. And you're not doing what I'm doing, or what, you know, what Tony's doing, or what other people are doing here in this space, right? So it's not the same for you as it is for those of us who are enmeshed in it all the time. And anyway, it's just kind of interesting, endlessly so. Okay. Let's go to our next point. Oh, sure. Yeah, Joe, we can talk about that another time for sure. But yeah, I know it's interesting to other nations that we have our Pledge of Allegiance and that sort of thing. Every nation has its own things to foster, create and foster nationalism and patriotism in its citizens. Every nation has that. How they go about doing it is different from place to place to place. But anyway, that's a whole different conversation. So thanks for asking about that. Okay, let's talk about social isolation. Cults often isolate members from family and friends outside the group, right? Obviously. And this can make it difficult to reconnect with that support system once you leave the cult. Fighting back against the cult can further strain those relationships, both with current members of the group. If they don't outright shun you or disconnect from you, you're going to have strained relationships there and with the rest of your existence, right? And of course we can get, the full-on disconnection or the shunning, right? That's definitely social isolation. The other aspect of this, that beyond the obvious of, oh, you left the cult, now you're isolated from those people, or, oh, they won't talk to you anymore. I mean, this we understand as a very obvious, very understood consequence of leaving a destructive cult is the sort of black and white us versus them. Oh, you're not with us, then you're against us. So, you know, fuck you very much and never darken our door again, tends to be the attitude there. But what does that leave the cult member in, the ex-cult member? What situation does that leave them in? Because generally speaking, most of the time, their entire social network was that group. So one of the challenges is building a new social network, because the existing one you had as part of the cult was generally a totalist system. So everybody you knew, or most everybody you knew and valued as relationships, are in the cult. So now you're out. Now you got to deal with that. You got to rebuild your social networks. And you have to do it in the face of all of this crap that you're carrying around with you. And who do you end up connecting with for the most part? Certainly my experience has been ex-cult members from your group. Right? That social network moves out into the real world, but it's different because it's no longer run or ruled over by the cult. So a lot of the same action patterns, habits, thoughts, right? The neural pathways are still in place. You're still used to acting like a cult member. You still think like a cult member. But you're now in this social situation where you can have any relationship you want with anybody you want, whenever you want. But can you, right? And are the relationships going to now be solid well-formed, organized attachments that are meaningful and compassionate and understanding and empathetic. And no, of course they're not going to be, right? Because you're not habituated to that. You're habituated to these awful cult-style relationships that are truly horrible. You know, people, and one of the first things that hit me so hard between the eyes when I first left Scientology was there are no friends in cults. They don't have friends. Not the way that people in the outside world understand that term. You only have fellow cult members. As long as you're a cult member, as long as you're a group member, you're all good. You can be a complete, and I mean, you can be a total fucking asshole in the cult. And you'll be surrounded by people who will call you friend because you're a fellow cult member. They'll excuse all kinds of bad behavior. They'll excuse all kinds of nonsense because you're a fellow cult member, right? You step out of that paradigm and you try to act that way out in the real world, people don't want to have anything to do with you. This is really hard, this adjustment of this, right? So you don't have friends in that situation. You only have fellow cult members. You come out, and now you're trying to make friends, but you kind of still act. Anyway, you know, you got to get the idea how I'm talking about all this. It's all conditional. That's right. It's all conditional. And we tend to drag that conditionality, if you will, into our relationships outside the cult. And, of course, this would be an appropriate place for me to bring this up, so I will. Because it's a fact, it's not an opinion that I have, and it's and I'm not saying any of this pointing to any individual person. But the fact of the matter is that if you don't undo all the cult stuff, which takes time and education and effort and often therapy, but not always, but whatever it's going to take, you got to do that work. And it takes a long time to do that work because it took a long time to get you into the headspace you were in being in the cult. You know, cult survivors are not people who go do one Div 6 Scientology course. You know, it's when you're in for years, when you've done an RPF, when you've like really been through some abuse, right? You're a very different person when you come out of that. And you know, so the longer people are involved in this stuff, the more work there is for them when they come out. And if you grew up in it, holy fucking shit, right? You got to become a whole new person. And you don't know where to start. You don't know where to go. Like I said, directions are all over the place. You can go in any direction you want. And you're very habituated to these concepts of, you know, fellow cult members are friends, and so therefore you're looking for those kind of connections. And all those bad habits follow. And the whole black and white, us versus them thinking that has been so habituated in a person stays with them. And so I'll talk about me here. For years following leaving Scientology, for many, many years, I had the hardest time having relationships with people. I don't mean just romantic relationships, I mean friendships, because the slightest thing would set me off, you know? And if somebody sets you off and you're still in that kind of culty headspace, fuck you, get out of here, you know? They're gone, they're dead to you, just like that. All these, you know, here you are trying to create relationships and create friendships and build a life, but you're on a hair trigger the entire damn time, right? And this all, again, stays sort of present for if you're immersed in the situation of going back and fighting the cult, all this stuff kind of stays there, right? It's constantly there. So it can be really hard to make friends. It can be really hard to not be incredibly judgmental of those relationships that you're forming. It can be hard, in other words, to not be an asshole, right? And you know, yep, that's right. That's how it goes. So that can cause further social isolation is my point, where I was trying to go to with that, right? Is even when you're out of the cult, the social isolation of being in the cult, it follows you. And it's so hard to undo that stuff. And also relearn what it means to be in a society of free will, of free thinkers, of people who have choices. Because when you're in a society or a culture that is bound, that all the choices are bound, like a Scientology Sea Org operation or, you know, something like that, or Nexium or some, you know, some group where, you know, your life is dictated by this group. Out in the big wide world, people have choices. People have all kinds of ideas and attitudes and opinions about things that are not conformist. And you can be so used to conforming, right? That when other people don't, you're like offended. You know, how could you not think that? You know what? How could you possibly, right? You get this very like, oh, I struggled for years with this. I probably still do. I mean, to one degree or another, but at least I can spot it now. X-Sion gives a great example of another reason why this can be a problem and can create social isolation. I never wanted to talk to anyone about my Scientology traumas because of being judged as a stupid person for having gotten involved in the first place. Yeah, the judgments go both ways out in the real world, don't they, right? And you can actually isolate for fear of having those judgments come at you. Now, of course, when you start putting yourself out there as an ex-cult fighter or as a, you know, somebody who's going to fight the abusers, you're going to be faced with new challenges from the social perspective of people who are not going to believe you, people who are going to call you you just got an axe to grind, you're just a bitter apostate on the fringes of the internet. You know, you will get this attitude from far more people than just the cult. There are no shortage of people out there who have absolutely horrible opinions and are absolutely happy to share them with you at the drop of a hat. And will judge you as harshly or even sometimes more harshly than your cult did. That can be a learning experience. Oh boy, can it. So these are again challenges, right? Challenges. Trying to get along with your fellow ex-cult members when all of this is brewing is hard. It's harder. I'm gonna say it. It's harder than just regular difficult relationships out there, right? Because there's all this baggage. It's real. It manifests. We see it. I've called it. I've called some aspects of that, some of the noisy, attack-ridden, crazy aspects of that. I've called that trauma drama. I've gotten a lot of shit for that. Stand by what I said, because it is what it is, right? There's, you know, you can get so involved in all of that triggering and all of that nonsense that you just see everybody as an enemy because it's a carryover of the cult stuff where everybody who ain't you, who doesn't think like you, is an enemy. That's the whole point of being in the cult, and what the cult convinces you of is that everybody who doesn't think like you is an enemy. Not just another person who's free to think what they want. No, they are your enemy. They exist to destroy you. That's the level of heightened, you know, dare I say paranoia, right? Us versus them, that cults focus on creating. And we carry it with us when we leave. And we carry it around with us when we fight the cult. And if we don't have other people on the same page as us, every minute, you're the enemy now. You know, and then comes the infighting. Certainly done my share of it over the years to understand what it looks like, what it feels like, and how wrong it is. You know, but it is what it is. It's people being people. So there's that challenge. That's a challenge in this space. And it's true in every single ex-cult space. It's not just a Scientology thing by any stretch of the imagination. It's not just a cult thing. You know, this is social behavior I'm talking about. And individuals with trauma in a social situation will sometimes have a very difficult time because of that trauma. Okay. Yeah, the whole you're either with us or against us thing. That's exactly right. Yeah, okay. Oh, Michelle, I did not catch that yet. Thank you for pointing out that, because I actually want to see your interview on Life After MLM with Mark and Claire Headley, so I will check that out. Thanks for putting that in the comments there. That's good. All right, let's get on with the next point, because we have points to go over here, and I don't want to spend... Oh my gosh, yes, 50 minutes in, and we still got a ways to go, so let's carry on. Financial consequences. Dun, dun, dun. Financial consequences. Some cults require members to donate significant amounts of money or assets, leading to financial hardship upon leaving. Yeah. Or they don't demand that you give a lot of money. They demand that you give your life, right? You go become a Sea Org member. You go do full-time TM. You join the central headquarters, and you start working for the organization or something like that. And you're investing in giving over not money. You are giving over your time and your energy and you, right? Legal battles or advocacy efforts against the cult may incur additional financial costs, further exacerbating the strain on individuals. Yes. So the financial situation and the financial difficulties of fighting cults are real. And I'm going to rant for a second here, but this is informed ranting, okay? It has been so frustrating for me personally, for the last 10 years, to watch absolutely no question about it, objectively, factually true, abusive personalities, predators, manipulators, people who have absolutely no business having a microphone in front of their face because all they do is use it to lie and cheat and deceive people and steal from them. It has been so frustrating to watch the success of such people over and over and over again, to watch how our society rewards these people while the people who fight back against such people and such groups, whether it's ex-Scientologists, ex-Mormons, government corruption, religious corruption, you know, I name drop Joel Osteen here all the time because I'm so sick and tired of this grifter. Right, with their G6 jets and their million-dollar mansions that they must have for Jesus, quote unquote. It's so rampant, it's so blatant, and it's so obvious that I just start chewing the damn carpet. You know, I really get frustrated over this, and this is my own emotional need of justice and the injustice trigger. Right, I got a big one. And this has been incredibly frustrating for me, not only to watch the riches that flow endlessly into the coffers of these manipulators and liars, but to watch how hard it is to generate funds or resources to fight them. It's across the boards. It's uniform, right? It doesn't matter. It's not just in the cult world, but it, you know, if you try to bring education, if you try to bring help, if you try to bring support for victims, you are fought, you are insulted, you are degraded, you are told, you know, a litany, a laundry list of reasons why you're a stupid idiot. This is a consequence of doing this work, is you have to live with the injustice of that. And you have to know that this is not the path to riches. This is not the path to a comfortable life, even. There is no financial reward in doing this work. None. You barely get by. And the reward is not money. The reward is helping people. And you have to live with that because you're never going to get rich doing this, right? Not this work. If you want to do work like what I was just describing, you can get rich, right? You can do that work and go get rich. But helping people, right? I mean, again, first responders know this, right? Essential workers know this. This isn't just, you know, me just sitting here complaining about this, right? Or, you know, education in general, woefully, horribly underfunded and inadequately compensated for. That's my rant, okay? But I, like I said, it's an informed rant. It is based not just on this subject, but in the big wide world, horrible behavior is amply rewarded. Good behavior is barely rewarded, ever. That sucks. And that's yet part of the picture that you got to deal with in doing this work, right? Is that just how it is? All right. So that's the financial consequence. At least that's the aspect of it that I wanted to mention, right? Anyway, I think you guys get it. I'm not going to belabor it, but man, is it frustrating. All right, let's carry on. sorry, my carpet munching example. I just shared the carpet. Maybe that's the wrong example or the wrong analogy or phrase or whatever. All right, legal challenges. Let's get to that. Destructive cults may employ legal tactics to silence critics. This is a thing. We all know this is a thing, right? Fair gaming, etc. And that can be challenging as individuals may struggle to adjust to societal norms, rebuild social networks, and regain trust in others, right? We're struggling with all of this stuff, and then we have to get sued. We have to get cease and desist letters. We have to pay lawyer fees. We got to deal with all the legal machinations that these cults that have millions, sometimes billions of dollars can throw against their critics, and the critics have nothing in return, right? Unless they can get grants or donations or somehow are, you know, independently wealthy, which never happens. You know, you're desperately waiting for a... you know, a sugar daddy, something, you know, a source of money. Because if they come after you as a cult critic, you are in a very vulnerable place, you know, for the most part, legally. Legal system is pay to play, especially in the United States, If you want competent legal representation in this country and you want to legally take on a billion or multi-million dollar organization, you better come with tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars ready to burn. Just throw those piles of money into the fireplace because it's going to go there so fast. It'll make it, it really does make your head spin. It is shocking how fast this happens. And I'm even at the individual level where you can watch an individual try to take on other individuals who are doing bad things to them, not even multi-million dollar organizations. What's, you know, stalking and harassment and cyber stalking and cyber harassment. Just, I mean, really think about, go look at what it takes to fight that. I tried to list out some of the issues and problems with cyber stalking and cyber harassment recently because, you know, it was something I got a sort of a front row seat to. And holy cow, man, the expenses involved in trying to prosecute your stalker, right? All the crap that Scientology pulls in the courtroom, these individuals, these predators, these manipulators, they pull it too. And it's all, if they got some money behind them or they can, you know, or get some resources, it can cost so much money to take them out that way. It can bankrupt you. So that is a very, very legitimate part of the picture of being an ex-cult member or coercive control survivor. Is getting justice is very, very rarely something you can get for free. You know, we have seen over the years, and if you guys have followed my channel for years, and some of you have, you've seen how there how many cases get lost or thrown out or just don't go anywhere, civil suits, for example, because you have to hire a pro bono attorney who's operating on contingency. And so you don't have to pay them up front, but you know the quality of the work you're going to get, probably not that good. So far, history has shown us, at least in the Scientology realm, that, you know, if you're not ready to bring it and you don't have a good amount of money to do so, good luck with that, right? Oh my God, red pill, Jesus. All right. Yeah, are you okay, man? All right. So legal challenges are a very real thing. Okay. And again, this applies, just want to highlight, underline, and boldface that this very, very much applies to individuals who have survived domestic abuse or other coercive situations as well, and are often destitute, bankrupt, or not. And even if they're not destitute or bankrupt, they're still not in a position, especially in our modern economy, to even begin to go get legal advice, much less hire an attorney and really bring a case, right? That is such a challenge, such a challenge. So anyway, I want to throw that out there. Oh, really? Wow. Wow, Michelle. Yeah, this is happening en masse, fair gaming to anti-MLMers this past week. Both Julie and Alonda have been targeted with YouTube strikes and Meta permanently disabling accounts. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. And try to fight back against that, and you don't have any money, good luck. I don't mean to say don't do the fight. But man, is it suddenly so much more challenging when you are faced with those barriers. Okay. Yeah, they just do. Okay. So it's a challenge. Now, just to point out, right, if you can get the right people on board and you can get the timing right and you can and everything kind of comes together for you, you can have amazing results in the legal arena against predators and abusers. And the perfect example of that is Keith Raniere and Nexium. That motherfucker ain't never coming out of jail, ever. He's dying in jail. Deservedly so. I am extremely happy about that. That man was an incredibly horrible sexual abuser, and he deserves to be separated from society for the rest of his life. He cannot be trusted. That was a success. It took many, many years of dedicated effort on the part of many people to make that happen, though. And you really got to understand how much effort it takes to bring these people to justice. It's not a lawsuit. Right? It's not one criminal conviction. It's hard to do this work. Okay. Let's carry on. Next point. We are at point six now. Reintegration challenges. Okay. Now, we covered this a little bit already in terms of, reintegrating into mainstream society after leaving a cult can be challenging, as individuals may struggle to adjust to societal norms, rebuild social networks, like we talked about, right? Fighting back against the cult may prolong this process as individuals confront the cult's influence on their lives. This also brings in all the, you know, trauma, drama, and other nonsense that goes on in the infighting in the ex-cult world, where we start targeting each other rather than the cult, right, I consider this a reintegration challenge, right? Because getting along with other people, learning how to do that, learning how to be civil, learning how to not be so us versus them, so triggered all the time, this is hard. It's hard. There is no perfect person out there. There's nobody who's got it all right. And there's nobody who understands everything that's going on and is walking the perfect path of compassion and empathy for everybody. You know, that doesn't exist. We get into fights. We get into struggles. We have problems and issues. And we struggle to integrate or reintegrate. It's a constant fight. It's not any different than a marriage, really, or a friendship. It's work to have a good friendship. It's work to have a good marriage. You got to work your ass off. You don't just navigate it naturally because you're a good person. You know, it's hard for all of us. And it's 10 times harder when all the cult baggage is still on your face and everybody could be a potential enemy at any moment. You know, I've lived that. Totally have lived that. And it's so that in itself is one of the challenges here. Okay. Because you need allies. There's no way to do this work without allies. No one individual anywhere in this world successfully shuts down cults. There's a lot of individuals who think that they can do that. It's never happened. So people can think lots of things, but the truth is it's groups of organized people who take out these cults, not individuals. It's groups of people who get things done in this world. And most of that work that's getting done, fighting cults, by the way, isn't being done on camera, right? Education and awareness is what you do on camera. That's what you do here, right? That's what I'm trying to do. But we got to be organized. And in order to be organized, you have to have allies. In order to have allies, you got to get along with people. You got to get along to some degree with them. And you got to, like, that means, as I've had to learn, that means putting up with the things about them that you don't like as much as putting up with what you, you know, connecting with what you do like, you know, just the way of the world. All right. Now let's go to the next one here. Fear and intimidation. Okay, this is a real challenge. This one is for real. And I can tell you, as somebody who's sat in this seat doing this work, you know, let me read it first, then we'll go from there. Cults often use fear and intimidation tactics to control members and discourage dissent. We know this, right? Individuals who speak out against the cult may face threats, harassment, or other forms of retaliation, leading to heightened anxiety and stress. And this can come not only from the cult itself, but from people outside the cult too. Former members often have gripes and grudges, and the outside world can generate incredible levels of hostility. Now, I've made the point, I think, crystal clear about the ex-cult community and the struggles of that. But let's talk here about the outside world too. Because it's not just the cults that fair game. We really totally understand fair gaming here. Cults come after their critics. They try to ruin them utterly. They try to take them out. They'll sue them into bankruptcy, and they'll try to gen up or create criminal charges against their critics. Sometimes they're successful in that, send them to jail. Anything they can do to dead agent, right, nullify, in other words, or get rid of their critics, they will do. This we know. That behavior can be mirrored in the ex-cult world by people who are still mirroring cult behavior, right? But the outside world, too, can be incredibly challenging, because what you're trying to do as a cult fighter or coercive control fighter, right, is bring awareness, get people to know what's going on so that something can be done about it. Laws can be enacted or enforced, that kind of thing. And sometimes the outside world couldn't care less. Again, front row seat on this fairly recently in terms of cyber stalking, cyber harassment, the kind of stuff that goes on every day of the week all over the world, every town, everywhere, right? Somebody on your streets probably being cyber stalked. Trying to get the police, trying to get law enforcement, trying to get a lawyer to even listen to you about cases like that can be challenging beyond belief. Trying to get people to care, in other words, about you or your situation enough to do something about it can be a real sales job. It can be a real challenge. And sometimes people can be incredibly cruel. I was shocked. I really was. I shouldn't have been. But I was. I was really shocked when I first started doing video work and talking about this stuff at how callous so many viewers could be over, God, you got to be a moron to be in a cult. How could you have been so stupid? Oh, only idiots join cults. I used to hear this constantly. I'm actually encouraged by the fact I don't hear it as often anymore, but it still comes up, right? I mean, fairly regularly. Just not as much as it used to. And it's this constant refrain. You're going to get insulted. Your integrity is going to be questioned. Your intelligence is going to be questioned. Your everything about you is going to be questioned and put under the magnifying glass. And you're going to be judged incredibly harshly by people for even having been in that situation. If you were a domestic abuse survivor, if you are a cult survivor, if you are a gang survivor, a trafficking survivor, you are going to be blamed by whole swaths of our population for your situation. You are the one who caused it. You're the one who put yourself in that position. Why were you dressed that way? It's that attitude, and it's shocking how prevalent it is. You have to be prepared for that because there really isn't a whole lot you can do about it except ignore it and move on. And that really is what you need to do. Again, speaking from the school of hard knocks on that, I have done every mistake you can make, engaging hard, engaging really hard. You know, I've done it all. And it never satisfies. It's never a good thing to even try. You just ignore, block, and move on. Because this world has 8 billion people in it, and a whole lot of them couldn't care less and never will about anything having to do with you or your cult or your experience, right? They got their own problems or issues. They themselves are abusers, or they're just kind of, there's empaths and then there's apaths, right? Like people who just don't really care one way or the other about a whole lot of anything. And a world is full of those folks. So that's something that is hard to accept as an ex-cult member because we're so used to our black and white totalist thinking, right? Everybody should be on board. This is obvious, right? I mean, you can hear this is abusive. Yeah, whatever. You're shocked by the what? How can you? Yeah, that's people. So anyway, I don't mean to be like so super cynical here today. I'm not trying to be. I hope I'm not coming across as overly cynical today, but I'm trying to be honest about the challenges. And these are real challenges that can affect a person. They certainly, every one of these has affected me all the way to my core at different points over the last decade, trying to get the word out about this stuff. And I'm not even a major mover and shaker. I'm barely reaching anybody with the work I'm doing, but I'm trying, you know, and the feedback you get is all over the place. And sometimes it's, most of the time it's pretty good, but sometimes it's, you know, this kind of stuff. Okay. And finally, all right. Finally, spiritual crisis. This is variable for people, but we know that it's kind of a problem that comes up whether you're going to fight cults or not, right? Or fight domestic abuse survivors or whatever, right? But the spiritual crisis, specifically with cults, ex-cult members, is a real thing. You guys have heard me talk about this over the years. You've seen me go from, you know, pretty antagonistic to organized religion, pretty hostile to the concept of belief and faith, to a more tempered, more nuanced approach to that, where I don't have any hostility anymore toward people with faith or belief. I don't care what you believe. But but that change has been a long, gradual process for me of figuring out, you know, what the hell is spirituality anyway? If it's not what L. Ron Hubbard said it is, then what is it? You know, what are spirits? Are spirits even important? Is any of this important? Do I really need to have this as part of my life anymore? Do I have to have a spiritual component? And in fighting back against cults, and especially Scientology, you know, there's a whole lot of spiritual stuff connected with Scientology in a very rigid, very defined belief set and, or ideology, as we say. So that, the sort of dumping that or what parts to dump and all that is a challenge as in itself for ex-cult members. But as a former, as an attacker, as somebody who goes against them or is trying to take them down, you dig in even harder. I have. Into those belief sets and you're pulling them apart. You're trying to like, okay, what's good and what's bad about this? What's constructive and what's destructive? And your views about that will change over time. The things I used to argue about for Scientology or against Scientology might not necessarily be the same arguments I'm making now. I believe I'm making more nuanced arguments these days than I used to be. And I think that's the result of years of tearing this apart and analyzing it and thinking hard about it and reading and researching and talking with so many other people about their experiences with it. And that is, I think, a positive. I think all of this taking apart and analyzing and looking is helped me clarify. It's been very cathartic for me to do it. This is why I'm always talking about other people should do it too, because it helped me. I think it'll help everybody. But at the same time, right, the challenge here is that this may grapple. It can trigger a spiritual crisis for people leaving a cult or fighting a cult. They can grapple with questions of faith, meaning, and existential purpose as they reassess their beliefs and values. Probably the biggest struggle you saw me go through that I can offer up as an example here is the years-long struggle that I talked about of saving the world. Got to save the world, right? If I'm not on a track of saving the world, I'm a useless human being, right? This was my thinking when I first got out of Scientology. And for many years following, this was a very slowly diminishing idea in my mind because it aligned so closely with my emotional needs, my sense of purpose and meaning, and where I derive value for myself. So it had to do with self-image and ego too. All of this was wrapped up in this concept of saving the world. And letting go of that was one of the biggest struggles I had because it was literally core meaning and purpose for me. And realizing that was built on a foundational idea that was totally false, you know, was finally what it took to kind of get that out of my head. There is no saving the world. There's no such thing as saving the world. The world doesn't need saving. That's not what any individual is capable of doing anyway. Not one person in all of history saved the world. It doesn't work that way, right? Societies, people, we just don't, we can make movies about it, but that's about as far as it goes. You know, the reality of the big wide world is it ain't going to get saved. It's going to keep going the way it's going, and things are going to change. And that's the reality of things. And how they change and where they change and what they change into, most of us have absolutely no control over whatsoever. We have control over ourselves, our immediate life, what we say, what we do. That's what we have control over, right? And you can manipulate or motivate people, you know, one or the other, right, around you to try to get them to conform with what you think is a good thing to do. And that's it. That's all the power you got, you know, as an individual, which is why allying and getting part of a group and organizing is so damn important. But as far as spiritual crisis and faith goes, that's how it touched my life the hardest. It's not representative of everybody. I'm not pretending that it is. I know, you know, not everybody had the whole save the world thing. There were tons of people who were involved in Scientology or other cults or other groups who have had no idea that that's what they were part of or what they were doing, and they didn't have any personal realization or goals or meaning connected with that. But when it came to Scientology, it wasn't for lack of us trying to instill that purpose in them. It's a constant refrain in Scientology. You know, gaining your eternity, saving the world, clearing the planet, same thing, right? Same concept. Fluffy Wickets. Well, welcome to the show as we're wrapping up. Okay. Still waiting for AI to realize the world needs saving from humans. Yeah, well, I have varying degrees of pessimism on that particular thought, actually. I've definitely embraced that thinking before. It's very easy to imagine people are just a virus on the face of this planet, and the sooner the planet, you know, gets rid of us, the better. But at the same time, I have other much more constructive ideas about us. All right, so those were basically the 8 points I wanted to cover today, right? Basically, overall, fighting back against a destructive cult can be a complex and challenging process that takes a significant toll on an individual's emotional, social, financial, and spiritual well-being. It is essential for individuals to seek support from trusted friends, family members, therapists, support groups, and legal professionals to navigate these challenges and heal from their experiences. Pretty good, pretty decent summary there. So that's kind of what this show was about today, the podcast here. I hope that this was informative, educational, and entertaining for everybody who was here. I very much appreciate the feedback that we got today. I kind of don't want this to end, but at the same time, I have completed what I came here to say, so I'm not going to belabor this or drag it out. Tomorrow you guys are getting 3 days in a row of live from me, because tomorrow we are going to do another live Q&A. I'm pretty much given over to the fact that we're going to be doing them live, I think, for the most part from now on. And I'm totally happy with that. I love going live with you guys. But we are probably going to move it a little bit later into the afternoon. Probably this same time is when we will do it tomorrow rather than in the morning slot. I'm going to do it at the 1 o'clock slot tomorrow. Just same time that we did today. Okay. So that's kind of where we're at with that. Joe. Yeah. I will do that, Joe. I will note down your question for tomorrow, but I would love it if you would be here tomorrow and ask me again. Okay. put it right back on you. Now, I will try to get that in there and put it on one of my post-it notes here so I don't forget that tomorrow. Okay. Good. So I will see you guys there. Good. Thanks, Joe. And let's have a good afternoon today. Have a great Saturday. And thanks for coming around and listening to me blabber on about all this. I really, really, really hope that everyone in the ex-Scientology community somehow listens to this. I doubt that's going to happen. Somehow I've become persona non grata amongst people that I'm still just completely confused about the whole thing. It doesn't make any sense to me what's going on. Other than what I've described today, right? That's how it makes sense to me. But, anyway, I hope that that this messaging and this stuff can get out there, because I think it is a real struggle for a lot of us to do this work. And I think that just acknowledging that hopefully could, help bring down the temperature a little bit. So there's that. And, Exion, my tattoo here says... It says it's chaos. Be kind. This is the motto of my life, is this tattoo here. I really strive for this. I don't succeed at it all the time, but I really strive. Okay. All right, guys. So thanks for coming around. Let's go ahead and wrap up. And I will see you tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel. All right.